That's it for the Wrecking Hours. Catch me next week, same time, same place. Monday Talk Forum up next. With Earth Sky and TED Talks with Daphne Koller.
This is Salif Diarra, a local health worker in a remote village in Mali, West Africa. This is Mori, a child who survived malaria because of Salif's efforts. This is Bintu, a grateful mother, one of many in Salif's village. This is you, becoming part of the story. Help local health workers like Salif make the good go even further. Visit goodgoes.org to see the many ways you can help. Brought to you by Save the Children and the Ad Council.
This is WHFR, Dearborn.
Henry Ford Community College has a medical practice clinical management degree program that will prepare you for a rewarding career in the exciting field of healthcare. You can earn a certificate as a medical office assistant or a two-year degree in medical office management. For more information, give us a call at 800-585-HFCC.
Think you have what it takes? We do. Henry Ford Community College. Visit us online at hfcc.edu.
Hey, this is Scotty Robinson with a gospel music review, encouraging all of you loyal WHFR listeners to tune in every Wednesday night between the hours of 10 p.m. and 12 midnight. That's right, we'll be bringing you the best and brightest blends of contemporary and traditional gospel music on the Gospel Music Review. Gospel rap, hey, we got it. Quartets, we got that. Mass choirs, we got that too. So if you're interested in listening to great gospel music, tune in every Wednesday night between the hours of 10 p.m. and 12 midnight with your host, yours truly, Scotty Robinson, here on the Gospel Music Review on the only station making waves. That's 89.3 FM.
Disclaimer, this show is a WHFR talk show presentation. The opinions expressed by WHFR staff and our guests are not necessarily those of anyone here at Henry Ford Community College, not faculty, staff, administrators, anyone on our Board of Trustees, or students.
Earth Sky.
Welcome to Earth Sky 22, 22 minutes of science interviews and great music from Austin, Texas. I'm Jorge Salazar. This week, a full moon for skywatchers and a blue moon later in August. Research on the next generation of biofuels from grasses and the weird science of hairballs. Here's a scientist soundbite.
Coming up this week on August 1st or 2nd, depending on where you are in the globe, we're going to have the first full moon of August. And for us in the U.S., coming up on August 31st, we're going to have the second full moon of August, which many people will call a blue moon.
That's Skywatcher Deborah Bird. More with her later. But first, science news of the week with Michael Brennan and Emily Howard.
Scientists have discovered a biological switch in cyanobacteria that reacts to light and changes how electrons are transported within the cells. The new findings could help in engineering blue-green algae for improved biofuel production. The results of the research were published on July 10th in Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences.
The U.S. Department of Agriculture said on July 25th that the severe drought now affecting major portions of the U.S. means consumers can expect to pay more for groceries in 2013. Products that might increase in price include milk, beef, chicken, and pork. They said to expect prices to be 3 to 4% higher.
There may be drought in the U.S., but meanwhile, the heaviest rainfall in 61 years fell on the Chinese capital city of Beijing on July 21st. China's state news agency at first said 37 people were killed, but changed that number a few days later to 77.
On July 24th, NASA announced that Greenland saw unprecedented ice sheet melting at the surface during a period of only 4 days in early July. On July 8th, 40% of Greenland was experiencing thawing at the surface. By July 12th, nearly 97% of Greenland was experiencing surface thaw. This is the largest surface melting in Greenland ice recorded in the past 30 years, since satellites have been observing Greenland ice.
A series of dust storms, also known as haboobs, took place in the U.S. state of Arizona in the past few weeks. During the summer months in that part of the U.S., weak thunderstorms over the desert can create strong winds, which pick up dust that might travel many miles. We have some great photos of the July 2012 Arizona dust storms at earthsky.org. Search for the word dust.
Astronomers say they've detected a distant solar system whose planets orbit in a way that resembles the planets in our solar system. It is 10,000 light years away. At the center of this faraway system is Kepler-30, a star as bright and massive as our sun. It orbits nearly upright with respect to the plane of its planets' orbits, much as our sun does. Prior to this discovery, most exoplanets discovered in recent years, particularly the giant planets known as hot Jupiters, have been seen to have far more eccentric orbits. That's Science News of the Week. I'm Emily Howard.
And I'm Michael Brennan. Don't forget to check out the Delta Aquarid meteor showers this week. Find info about it at earthsky.org. While you're there, you can order an awesome lunar calendar for 2013. This week's Song of the Week is called A Lie. By the Eastern Sea off their new album, Plague.
I guess that was a lie.
We're Earth Sky, broadcast on over 1,200 stations worldwide, including Voice of America. Deborah Bird joins us now with news of the global night sky, a blue moon coming later in August. Welcome, Deborah.
Hey, Jorge. So there are different definitions of the term blue moon, and people love to argue about this, which I don't understand exactly why they love to argue about it, but they do. It's all just folklore, after all. But one of the definitions of a blue moon is the second full moon of a month. And so coming up this week on August 1st or 2nd, depending on where you are in the globe, we're going to have the first full moon of August. And for us in the U.S., coming up on August 31st, we're going to have the second full moon of August, which many people will call a blue moon.
Awesome. So give us some tips on how to see this this full moon that's coming up. August 1st, what are we looking for?
Well, any full moon is visible when the sun goes down at night. And many people think that every moon, every night is visible when the sun goes down. That's not true. The moon orbits the Earth. And the definition of a full moon is that it's opposite the sun. So when the sun is going down in the west, the full moon is rising in the east, and it's visible all night long. So both this August 1st or 2nd full moon and the August 31st full moon will be visible all night long, very easy to see. They won't be the color blue. It's not that we're going to look up there and see a moon that's blue in color. This is a blue moon, but it's going to be blue in name only.
And why is it so rare to have a blue moon? Tell us more about this folklore of the blue moon.
Well, as I said, not everybody agrees on the definition of blue moon. And the definition of the blue moon as being the second full moon in a month is relatively recent. In fact, it's only been in the past few decades that people have been using the term blue moon to describe the second full moon of a month. Prior to that, there was this idea that the blue moon was the third full moon of four full moons in a season. And that's kind of hard to remember. It's not the fourth full moon of four in a season, but it's the third of four in a season. So that's kind of a more arcane and a little bit harder to remember definition. And I think that's one reason that the second full moon in a month definition caught on so quickly and so many people like it. But even earlier than that, there was this idea that the blue moon was something that was very, very, very rare. And, that definition came from centuries ago. It's kind of like saying the moon is made of green cheese or something like that. There's, the blue moon is very rare. Once in a blue moon, it's something that happens very rarely. In fact, if you use the definition of, either the blue moon as the third of four in a season or the second full moon of a month, it's not all that rare an event.
So how rare is it?
Well, in fact, seven times in every 19 years, there are 13 full moons in a year. So that gives, during those years, there are 11 months with one full moon and 1 month with two full moons. So the second full moon in a month in modern times has come to be called a blue moon. Not all that rare. Every 2 to 3 years, we get one.
So this August 31st blue moon is the second full moon of this month. When is the next blue moon by that other definition that you gave us?
Yeah. So the other definition is the third of four full moons in a season, and the next blue moon by that definition is also coming up pretty soon, and that would be August 21st of the year 2013.
Oh, okay. Something to look forward to. Thanks, Deborah.
Thank you, Jorge.
Earth Sky's Deborah Bird, and we're Earth Sky, a clear voice for science. We're Earth Sky. We interview the world's top scientists. In late July of 2012, the U.S. Department of Energy awarded a $12 million five-year research grant to develop grasses that can tolerate drought for use in biofuels. Scientists will study the grass commonly known as green foxtail, a non-native weed. This grass has been described as a lab rat, closely related by its genetics to next-generation biofuel crops, such as miscanthus and switchgrass, as well as to corn. On the line to talk more about this research is plant biologist Andrew Leakey of the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. His lab will study the green foxtail plant. Dr. Leakey, welcome.
Thank you very much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Describe for us this new research project funded by the U.S. Department of Energy. It deals with biofuels made from grasses. What do you intend to do, and how are you doing this?
Yes, so this is a new $12 million grant from the Department of Energy. It's being led by the Donald Danforth Plant Science Center in St. Louis, with me as a partner at the University of Illinois, and with other partners at the Carnegie Institute, Washington State University, and University of Minnesota. So it's a big team. And what we're really collaborating to do is to utilize genomic computational and engineering tools to begin to understand the genes which underpin drought tolerance in C4 grasses, and specifically a new model grass, Soteria viridis. And our hope is that we can use that new model grass, which we can kind of think of as being a bit of a lab rat for C4 crops, to identify genes and pathways that we could use to improve closely related feedstock grasses, such as Miscanthus and also switchgrass. And what we're going to be doing here at the University of Illinois is a large set of experiments where we assess a diverse panel of these grasses and relate variation in their genome sequence with variation in their drought tolerance.
Dr. Leakey, why are scientists doing this? Why are scientists exploring ways to turn grasses into fuel?
So I guess that big-scale objective is really to reduce reliance on fossil fuels, which at the minute are largely imported from outside the country. And then, you know, we're also really trying to slow the release of carbon emissions and slow the climate change that those are causing.
And to follow up on that, why grasses? Why are scientists, why did you choose these grasses? I believe they're, one of them is commonly known as green foxtail, is a weed. Why choose this grass as the focus of your study?
So the reason for really picking green foxtail millet or Soteria is that it has a couple of ideal characteristics which make it very scientifically tractable or easy to work with. So we have a genome sequence. It has a short life cycle, which means we can rapidly get it to produce new seeds and cross different genotypes together. It can be genetically modified relatively easily, which is important from an experimental point of view. And then apparently, possibly most critically, it's a very close relative of some of our existing food crops, such as maize and sorghum, but it's also closely related to these new biofuel feedstock grasses like Miscanthus and switchgrass. And those are getting interest because they can generate very large amounts of biomass in relatively short amounts of time, and that's what you really need in order to make fuel. Our team is really focused on how you produce the greatest amounts of grass biomass. You know, if you went out and harvested it, the greatest amount of that dry matter material you get at the end of the year, and doing that on the smallest possible land area with the smallest possible environmental impact. And so that's what we're really trying to explore, is how you can maximize production, maybe not using the best soils, not having to irrigate as much as you might otherwise do, not having to put on too much fertilizer. You know, those are very important features in producing a biofuel that actually has a net environmental benefit.
Now, may I follow up also what you said earlier, and this is in describing this project, help us get past the jargon a little bit. You talked about studying the genomics of these plants. Maybe in a nutshell, how are you studying these grasses? What are you doing?
So if you think of the genome sequence, you know, it's this the blueprint of how a plant is built that's encoded in its DNA. So we have two parents at the starting point for this study. They're both foxtail millets. They differ in many of their characteristics. And our teammates at the Danforth Center have crossed these together to get a few hundred offspring. And those offspring represent you know, the shuffled combinations of the DNA sequences from those parents. And really what we're doing is then growing them out in the field, exposing them to drought stress, and looking at how the variation in the way those two genomes have been shuffled together correlates with how their drought stress varies. And by doing that, that we can hopefully pick up on particular genes and processes which underpin drought tolerance, and then start to study those in additional detail.
Mm. And the whole goal, I imagine, is to be able to come up with a plant that can be grown easily without very much water or fertilizers on land that really isn't considered usable by a lot of people, which would be good for grasses for biofuels.
Yes, certainly there is an opportunity to take advantage of land that has been abandoned out of agriculture over the last century or so, and put that back to productive use in order to generate an environmentally friendly fuel that's produced here in the U.S.
What's the most important thing you want people today to know about biofuels research?
I think what we really want people to know today is that, you know, we have new tools. Science has new tools with which we can try to tackle the drought stress, which has been challenging agriculture since its inception 7,000 or 8,000 years ago, and which is likely to become, you know, an increasing problem this century. And I think that's a reason for us to be excited as scientists, and it's a cause for hope in general.
You've been listening to plant biologist Andrew Leakey. We're Earth Sky, a clear voice for science. We'd love to hear from you on Facebook. Tell us where you're from. You can find us as Earth Sky. Ryan Britton is back with another weird science story. Welcome, Ryan.
Thanks. I'm glad to be here. So I'm a bit sheepish today. I have a short and gross weird science story for you all. It's a story about a giant hairball.
Ooh, okay.
Yeah. This is actually a foul-smelling, giant, 2.5 kilogram, that's over 5 pounds, hairball that I'm going to tell you guys about today. And this hairball was in a human being.
Wow.
This is actually a 45-year-old woman who showed up earlier this year at a London hospital. She had abdominal pain and difficulty swallowing, and they quickly found this giant hairball in her stomach.
Okay, so then what happened?
Well, they asked her how it got there. And she said she enjoyed preparing what's called cow's feet stew. And she actually enjoyed the meat with the skin and hair still attached to it. So over the course of 8 years, she had a lot of this stew. Apparently it was one of her culinary favorites. And she ate all that indigestible hair. So it added up. So
well, that's incredible, but kind of predictable.
Yep. And well, it wasn't the first time that she had this particular issue. So let me say first that this woman didn't have any underlying psychiatric condition. She just really liked the stew. And as I mentioned, she had gone into the hospital 8 years prior, 8 years before, with a very similar problem. So she is actually one of the few recorded records of what's called recurrent trichobezoar, or recurrent giant hairball, in the world. But you know, she's given up cow's feet stew for now, and she's made a full recovery. So,
Ryan, I kind of hate to ask this, but in the interest of science inquiry, is there more information on the web about this story of giant hairballs?
Yep, there is. I didn't see any pictures, so that's a good thing, I think. But you can read more about it at improbable.com, or you can view the source report by the doctors at Homerton University Hospital in London at casereports.bmj.com.
Thanks, Ryan.
Thank you.
Earth Sky is Ryan Britton, and we're Earth Sky, a clear voice for science. And that's our show. Thank you for joining us. This week's show was recorded at the Earth Sky Studios in Austin, Texas, the live music capital of the world. Our producer is Michael Brennan. Executive producers are Peter Zandan, Ryan Britton, and Deborah Bird. And special thanks this week to our musical contributors. For more information on the science and the music you heard this week, visit our website at earthsky.org. Earth Sky is a clear voice for science.
There are too many artists, too much art, and not enough genius, I believe. Science is the art of the next stage. There are so many artists, too much art, and not enough reason, I'm afraid. Silence is the song of the next stage.
This is Philosophy Bites with me, David Edmonds.
And me, Nigel Warburton.
Philosophy Bites is available at www.philosophybites.com.
Philosophy Bites is made in association with the Institute of Philosophy.
Should hate speech be outlawed? Use of the N-word, say. In the US, extensive free speech is said to be guaranteed by the First Amendment. But in Europe, there are laws that restrict speech targeting particular groups, racist speech, for example. Should America be more like Europe? Yes, says Ray Langton of MIT. The mistake made by free speech fundamentalists is to regard speech as nothing but harmless words.
Ray Langton, welcome to Philosophy Bites.
Thank you, Nigel. Thanks for inviting me.
The topic we're going to focus on today is hate speech. Could you say what hate speech is?
I don't have any special definition, but when you see how people have talked about hate speech, you can see that one important idea is that of words or pictures that do something distinctive to a certain class or group of people. So, for instance, the UN describes hate speech as incitement to hatred or promotion of hatred or incitement to violence against members of certain groups or hatred towards members of certain groups. And it asks its member states to have legislation that will penalize that sort of speech. So that's one idea, which I'll put together under the idea of propaganda. Another idea, which I think is really important, is the idea of words that wound, where the basic thought is not so much propaganda, but assault. So you're using words directly to attack somebody rather than to incite third parties to hatred.
I think I understand what you mean by hate speech as propaganda. This is presumably the kind of thing that was going on in the lead-up to the Second World War with the Nazi anti-Semitism, for instance, where Jews were portrayed as rats. Certain sorts of words were used to target that group, amongst others. Now, that's different from what you called words that wound, although obviously it could wound, which is presumably occurring in a one-on-one situation or is directed at a particular individual. Could you say a bit more about the words that wound?
Okay, so I remember a story about Hank Aaron, the baseball player, who at the time when he was about to overtake the famed Babe Ruth, he received a huge barrage of hate mail. And the hate mail that he received was like an assault. It was full of uses of the N-word. It referred to him as Jungle Bunny. The letters would say, "My gun is watching your every move." It was speech that was designed to personally attack him. And of course, it's the sort of material that can be psychologically devastating. But what I want to emphasize is that quite apart from the psychological effects, those words are being used to do something even in saying those very words. So what I have in mind here is a distinction that Austin introduced, although he wasn't interested in hate speech. J.L. Austin, the philosopher of language, wrote a book called How to Do Things with Words. One thing that interested him very much was the difference between three different kinds of things we do with our words. We use words that have certain meanings, and he called the action we perform when we use meaningful words the locutionary act. We use words to produce certain effects on our hearers. He called that the perlocutionary act. But we also use words just in themselves to do something directly. That was the idea that at first he called a performative and then later came to call an illocutionary act. And what interests me when thinking about these different dimensions of hate speech is how hate speech, both as propaganda and as assault, can be understood as a certain kind of illocutionary act. Of course, it is harmful in terms of its effects, but it's also harmful in itself.
Could you just clarify that a bit by giving some examples of illocutionary acts?
Well, Austin had some fantastic examples. And funnily enough, if we're interested in incitement to violence, which I mentioned already was part of the UN description, one of Austin's examples was the utterance, "shoot her." Think about one man saying, "shoot her," to another man with respect to a woman who's nearby. You could describe that a number of different ways. You could say, "he said shoot," meaning by shoot, to shoot with a gun as opposed to a bow and arrow. You could say, "by her, he meant the woman nearby." And if we described it that way, that would be what Austin called the locutionary act. You could also describe what happened next. The second man picked up a gun and shot the woman, let's suppose. I'm now embroidering Austin's example. And if that happened, and that was our description of what happened, we'd say that was the perlocutionary act in Austin's terms. But Austin would think we'd left something out, what the first person did in saying those words. And for Austin, a relevant illocutionary description might be, well, maybe the first man ordered the second. You know, was it an order? Was it a piece of advice? Was it a suggestion? Was it a joke? There are many different things that that action could have been, that shoot her. And if we don't think hard about what that is, we're missing out on what he thought was one of the most interesting dimensions of language.
I'm interested in how that way of thinking about language enlightens our understanding of hate speech.
One feature of many of Austin's examples is that it makes a difference who is saying the words. Even in that example I just gave, maybe it could only have been an order if the first man was in a position of authority relative to the second man. And for many of his examples, you know, I hereby christen this ship the Queen Elizabeth. There's a successful christening, provided they've got the right champagne and it's the right speaker and everything else in the ceremony is in order. But, and Austin's other example, suppose some low type was his phrase, suppose some low type grabs the champagne bottle and smashes it against the ship and says, I hereby name this ship the Generalissimo Stalin. Austin says, we all agree it would be an infernal shame, and we all agree that that would not have been a christening of the ship. So what this tells us is that certain sorts of speech acts can do something when they're said by a person who is authoritative relative to the hearer and will not do the same thing if they're not. Now, the reason I mentioned that example is that we can easily think of cases where what's being done towards members of a certain group is done to them at least partly in virtue of a kind of authority in a particular context that the speaker might have. So you mentioned Nazi Germany before. So when Der Stürmer, which was one of the major anti-Semitic papers, published their hate-filled pictures and essays, it mattered that it was from an influential paper that had the official backing of the government. And that kind of speech was authoritative speech that ranked a particular group as inferior, ranked them as vermin, ranked them as subhuman, legitimated violence against them. These ideas of ranking and legitimation, these are illocutionary ideas, and they are part of what's involved in propaganda. So it's important to think of who the speakers are and where they're coming from as well when you think about the possibility that speech might be doing more than simply expressing an idea.
Most discussions about hate speech are about the limits of freedom of speech. Are there consequences from your sort of approach that follow from how we should treat hate speech? Is it just a matter of understanding it as language?
There are different reasons why some people think that there should be no restrictions on speech, not even hate speech. One is because they are in the thrall of the idea that language doesn't do much. So that's the idea that sticks and stones may break my bones, but names will never hurt me. Then you sometimes find others backing exactly the same conclusion with the idea that speech is so important because it's so powerful and we need to have this power always available to us. I think that one thing that thinking about speech in general and hate speech in particular as a kind of speech act, one thing that it gives us is a clear way of understanding it as something more than inert words. It helps us think of language as a kind of action that's continuous with our other actions. This means that one common way of dismissing legislation designed to restrict certain forms of hate speech is just onto a losing wicket. Speech is not only words, it's not inert. When we use words, we're doing all sorts of stuff, especially if we are in positions of power. Moreover, what we're doing is not simply expressing ideas that might or mightn't be true. We're acting, we're altering norms. We are making certain things more permissible than they were before. We're making them less permissible than they were before. We are authoritatively sometimes saying that certain people are inferior, and that is one of the ways that structures of hierarchy are set up and maintained.
It seems to me there are two different models in how you might play this out in terms of the law. In Britain, there are quite strict laws about what you can say in public. If it's racist or homophobic, you may find yourself prosecuted. In the States, it's more complicated because of the history of First Amendment interpretation, which protects extensive freedom of speech. Are you saying that the British solution is better?
Well, I just want to comment that the British solution, as you're calling it, is a response to the UN requirement that member states have some laws on the books that will prevent the sort of thing that so horrified everybody in the Second World War, and which we've seen happen promoting genocide even more recently, as was the case in Rwanda, where the radios were taken over by Hutus calling the Tutsis cockroaches, and the campaign of hate speech was clearly part of what instigated that particular massacre. Now, the USA is the outlier on this. The USA has not adopted this sort of legislation, in part because it thinks it's in conflict with the First Amendment of the US Constitution. This is odd because there is nothing in the law that would really prevent the US having laws that were more similar to those that are in force in Europe, in part because they also have the 14th Amendment, which requires them to respect the equality of citizens as well. And equality is certainly something that anti-hate speech legislation cares about. Moreover, they already have many restrictions on speech, including restrictions on child pornography, including restrictions on, I don't know, insider trading. There are all sorts of things that you're not allowed to do with words. And there is this kind of fairy tale that the First Amendment lets it be that anything goes. And of course, it doesn't. So the UK policy is part of, to my mind, a relatively sane-minded European policy that many different countries have signed up to in different forms.
I'm interested in the part played by intention in so-called hate speech. Hate is usually something you're aware of. It's directed at somebody or something. Do you have to intend to harm somebody by your speech for it to be hate speech?
I think that there are certain paradigm cases where your description would be completely accurate. The kind of assault-like hate speech, the words that wound, that were sent to Hank Aaron, those definitely were deliberate, and it mattered that they were deliberate. They were deliberately aiming to be words that wound. But I do think that that mightn't always be the case. There will be some cases where what you do with your words might be worse than you mean it to. And in principle, there could be hate speech where people don't know what they're doing. There's so much that you can be unaware of as a speaker. Sometimes you're not aware of the background structures of authority fully that actually influence the force that your speech is going to have. And if your speech has that force, it can be hate speech even when you don't mean it to.
Generally, what you've been saying is the way to think about hate speech is not a series of words that are just uttered, but people doing things with words. And if we think about people doing things with words, we'll see that it's just another kind of action. And so there isn't really this special category of speech. And we don't need to separate out questions about speech from questions about other kinds of behaviour.
I think that's a really good way to put part of what I was wanting to say. Certainly, I was wanting to emphasise the continuities between speech and our other actions. I do think that speech is special, though, in ways that don't quite fit with what you said, because I agree with Mill that speech is important, partly because communication is so important to us. Part of what makes me sad about the debates about free speech at present is that in waving the flag for free speech, situations are created where communication gets harder instead of easier. When you allow a complete free-for-all of the most powerful speakers, that hurts communication for people lower down in the hierarchy. And so if we want a speech situation where everybody gets a chance to speak more freely, then that might involve watching out for the speech of those that are further up to let the voices lower down get heard.
Ray Langton, thank you very much.
Thank you, Nigel.
There's now a Philosophy Bites book published by Oxford University Press. For more information, go to www.philosophybites.com.
For more information about the Institute, go to www.philosophy.sas.ac.uk.
Like many of you, I'm one of the lucky people. I was born to a family where education was pervasive. I'm a third-generation PhD, a daughter of two academics. In my childhood, I played around in my father's university lab. So it was taken for granted that I attend some of the best universities, which in turn opened the door to a world of opportunity. Unfortunately, most of the people in the world are not so lucky. In some parts of the world, for example, South Africa, education is just not readily accessible. In South Africa, the educational system was constructed in the days of apartheid for the white minority. And as a consequence, today there is just not enough spots for the many more people who want and deserve a high-quality education. That scarcity led to a crisis in January of this year at the University of Johannesburg. There were a handful of positions left open from the standard admissions process, and the night before they were supposed to open that for registration, thousands of people lined up outside the gate in a line a mile long, hoping to be first in line to get one of those positions. When the gates opened, there was a stampede, and 20 people were injured, and one woman died. She was a mother who gave her life trying to get her son a chance at a better life. But even in parts of the world, like the United States, where education is available, it might not be within reach. There's been much discussed in the last few years about the rising costs of healthcare. What might not be quite as obvious to people is that during that same period, the costs of higher education tuition have been increasing at almost twice the rate, for a total of 559% since 1985. This makes education unaffordable for many people. Finally, even for those who do manage to get a higher education, the doors of opportunity might not open. Only a little over half of recent college graduates in the United States who get a higher education actually are working in jobs that require that education. This, of course, is not true for the students who graduate from the top institutions, but for many others, they do not get the value for their time and their effort. Tom Friedman, in his recent New York Times article, captured in the way that no one else could the spirit behind our effort. He said that big breakthroughs are what happens when what is suddenly possible meets what is desperately necessary. I've talked about what's desperately necessary. Let's talk about what's suddenly possible. What's suddenly possible was demonstrated by three big Stanford classes, each of which had an enrollment of 100,000 people or more. So to understand this, let's look at one of those classes, the machine learning class offered by my colleague and co-founder Andrew Ng. Andrew teaches one of the bigger Stanford classes. It's a machine learning class, and it has 400 people enrolled every time it's offered. When Andrew taught the machine learning class to the general public, it had 100,000 people registered. So to put that number in perspective, for Andrew to reach that same size audience by teaching a Stanford class, he would have to do that for 250 years. Of course, he'd get really bored. So, having seen the impact of this, Andrew and I decided that we needed to really try and scale this up to bring the best quality education to as many people as we could. So we formed Coursera, whose goal is to take the best courses from the best instructors at the best universities and provide it to everyone around the world for free. We currently have 43 courses on the platform from four universities across a range of disciplines, and let me show you a little bit of an overview of what that looks like.
Welcome to Calculus.
50 million people are uninsured.
Models help us design more effective institutions and policies.
We get unbelievable segregation.
So Bush imagined that in the future, you'd wear a camera right in the center of your head.
Mills wants the student of sociology to develop the quality of mind.
Hanging cable takes on the form of a hyperbolic cosine.
For each pixel in the image, set the red to zero.
Vaccine allowed us to eliminate poliovirus.
Does Lufthansa serve breakfast in San Jose? Well, that sounds funny.
So this is which coin you pick
And this is the two passes.
So in large-scale machine learning, we'd like to come up with computational...
It turns out, maybe not surprisingly, that students like getting the best content from the best universities for free. Since we opened the website in February, we now have 640,000 students from 190 countries. We have 1.5 million enrollments. 6 million quizzes in the 15 classes that have launched so far have been submitted, and 14 million videos have been viewed. But it's not just about the numbers. It's also about the people. Whether it's Akash, who comes from a small town in India and would never have access, in this case, to a Stanford quality course and would never be able to afford it. Or Jenny, who is a single mother of two and wants to hone her skills so that she can go back and complete her master's degree. Or Ryan, who can't go to school because his immune-deficient daughter can't be risked to have germs come into the house, so he couldn't leave the house. I'm really glad to say, recently we've been in correspondence with Ryan, that this story had a happy ending. Baby Shannon, you can see her on the left, is doing much better now, and Ryan got a job by taking some of our courses. So what made these courses so different? After all, online course content has been available for a while. What made it different is that this was a real course experience. It started on a given day, and then the students would watch videos on a weekly basis and do homework assignments. And these would be real homework assignments for a real grade with a real deadline. You can see the deadlines in the usage graph. These are the spikes, showing that procrastination is a global phenomenon. At the end of the course, the students got a certificate. They could present that certificate to a prospective employer and get a better job, and we know many students who did. Some students took their certificate and presented this to an educational institution at which they were enrolled for actual college credit. So these students were really getting something meaningful for their investment of time and effort. Let's talk a little bit about some of the components that go into these courses. The first component is that when you move away from the constraints of a physical classroom and design content explicitly for an online format, you can break away from, for example, the monolithic one-hour lecture. You can break up the material, for example, into these short, modular units of 8 to 12 minutes, each of which represents a coherent concept. Students can traverse this material in different ways, depending on their background, their skills, or their interests. So, for example, some students might benefit from a little bit of preparatory material that other students might already have. Other students might be interested in a particular enrichment topic that they want to pursue individually. So this format allows us to break away from the one-size-fits-all model of education and allow students to follow a much more personalized curriculum. Of course, we all know as educators that students don't learn by sitting and passively watching videos. Perhaps one of the biggest components of this effort is that we need to have students practice with the material. And really, in order to really understand it. There's been a range of studies that demonstrate the importance of this. This one that appeared in Science last year, for example, demonstrates that even simple retrieval practice, where students are just supposed to repeat what they already learned, gives considerably improved results on various achievement tests down the line than many other educational interventions. We've tried to build in retrieval practice into the platform, as well as other forms of practice in many ways. For example, even our videos are not just videos. Every few minutes, the video pauses and the students get asked a question.
Prospect theory, hyperbolic discounting, status quo bias, base rate bias, they're all well documented. So they're all well documented deviations from rational behavior.
So here the video pauses and the student types in the answer into the box and submits. Obviously, they weren't paying attention. So they get to try again. And this time they got it right. There's an optional explanation if they want, and now the video moves on to the next part of the lecture. This is kind of simple question that I, as an instructor, might ask in class. But when I ask that kind of a question in class, 80% of the students are still scribbling the last thing I said, 15% are zoned out on Facebook, and then there's the smarty pants in the front row who blurts out the answer before anyone else has had a chance to think about it. And I, as the instructor, am terribly gratified that somebody actually knew the answer. And so the lecture moves on before really most of the students have even noticed that a question had been asked. Here, every single student has to engage with the material. Now, of course, these simple retrieval questions are not the end of the story. One needs to build in much more meaningful practice questions, and one also needs to provide the students with feedback on those questions. Now, how do you grade the work of 100,000 students if you do not have 10,000 TAs? The answer is you need to use technology to do it for you. Now, fortunately, technology has come a long way, and we can now grade a range of interesting types of homework. In addition to multiple choice and the kinds of short answer questions that you saw in the video, we can also grade math, mathematical expressions, as well as mathematical derivations. We can grade models, whether it's financial models in a business class or physical models in a science or engineering class. And we can grade some pretty sophisticated programming assignments. So let me show you one that's actually pretty simple, but fairly visual. This is from Stanford's Computer Science 101 class, and the student is supposed to color correct that blurry red image. They're typing their program into the browser, and you can see they didn't get it quite right. Lady Liberty is still seasick. And so the student tries again, and now they got it right, and they're told that, and they can move on to the next assignment. This ability to interact actively with the material and be told when you're right or wrong is really essential to student learning. Now, of course, we cannot yet grade the range of work that one needs for all courses. Specifically, what's lacking is the kind of critical thinking work that is so essential in such disciplines as the humanities, the social sciences, business, and others. So we tried to convince, for example, some of our humanities faculty that multiple choice was not such a bad strategy. That didn't go over really well. So we had to come up with a different solution, and the solution we ended up using is peer grading. It turns out that previous studies show, like this one by Sadler and Good, that peer grading is a surprisingly effective strategy for providing reproducible grades. It was tried only in small classes, but there it showed, for example, that the student assigned grade on the y-axis are actually very well correlated with the teacher assigned grade on the x-axis. What's even more surprising is that self-grades, where the students grade their own work critically, so long as you incentivize them properly so they can't give themselves a perfect score, are actually even better correlated with the teacher grades. And so this is an effective strategy that can be used for grading at scale and is also a useful learning strategy for the students because they actually learn from the experience. So we now have the largest peer grading pipeline ever devised, where tens of thousands of students are grading each other's work, and quite successfully, I have to say. But this is not just about students sitting alone in their living room working through problems. Around each one of our courses, a community of students had formed, a global community of who was awake and working on the same problem. And so in many of our courses, the median response time for a question on the question and answer form was 22 minutes, which is not a level of service that I have ever offered to my Stanford students. And you can see from the student testimonials that students actually find that because of this large online community, they got to interact with each other in many ways that were deeper than they did in the context of the physical classroom. Students also self-assembled that any kind of intervention from us into small study groups. Some of these were physical study groups along geographical constraints and met on a weekly basis to work through problem sets. This is the San Francisco study group, but there were ones all over the world. Others were virtual study groups, sometimes along language lines or along cultural lines. And at the bottom left there, you see our multicultural universal study group where people explicitly wanted to connect with people from other cultures. There's some tremendous opportunities to be had from this kind of framework. The first is that it has the potential of giving us a completely unprecedented look into understanding human learning, because the data that we can collect here is unique. You can collect every click, every homework submission, every forum post from tens of thousands of students. So you can turn the study of human learning from the hypothesis-driven mode to the data-driven mode, a transformation that, for example, has revolutionized biology. You can use these data to understand fundamental questions, like what are good learning strategies that are effective versus ones that are not. And in the context of particular courses, you can ask questions like, what are some of the misconceptions that are more common, and how do we help students fix them? So here is an example of that, also from Andrew's machine learning class. This is a distribution of wrong answers to one of Andrew's assignments. The answers happen to be pairs of numbers, so you can draw them on this two-dimensional plot. Each of the little crosses that you see is a different wrong answer. The big cross at the top left is where 2,000 students gave the exact same wrong answer. Now, if two students in a class of 100 give the same wrong answer, you would never notice. But when 2,000 students give the same wrong answer, it's kind of hard to miss. So Andrew and his students went in, looked at some of those assignments, understood the root cause of the misconception, and then they produced a targeted error message that would be provided to every student whose answer fell into that bucket, which means that students who made that same mistake would now get personalized feedback telling them how to fix their misconception much more effectively. So this personalization is something that one can then build by having the virtue of large numbers. Personalization is perhaps one of the biggest opportunities here as well, because it provides us with the potential of solving a 30-year-old problem. Educational researcher Benjamin Bloom in 1984 posed what's called the two-sigma problem, which he observed by studying three populations. The first is the population that studied in a lecture-based classroom. The second is a population of students that studied using a standard lecture-based classroom, but with a mastery-based approach, so that students couldn't move on to the next topic before demonstrating mastery of the previous one. And finally, there was a population of students that were taught in a one-on-one instruction using a tutor. The mastery-based population is a full standard deviation, or sigma, in achievement scores better than the standard lecture-based class. And the individual tutoring gives you 2 sigma improvement in performance. To understand what that means, let's look at the lecture-based classroom. Let's pick the median performance as a threshold. So in the lecture-based class, half the students are above that level and half are below. In the individual tutoring instruction, 98% of the students are going to be above that threshold. Imagine if we could teach so that 98% of our students would be above average. Hence, the two-sigma problem. Because we cannot afford, as a society, to provide every student with an individual human tutor. But maybe we can afford to provide each student with a computer or a smartphone. So the question is, how can we use technology to push from the left side of the graph, from the blue curve, to the right side with the green curve? Mastery is easy to achieve using a computer, because a computer doesn't get tired of showing you the same video 5 times. And it doesn't even get tired of grading the same work multiple times. We've seen that in many of the examples that I've shown you. And even personalization is something that we're starting to see the beginnings of, whether it's via the personalized trajectory through the curriculum or some of the personalized feedback that we've shown you. So the goal here is to try and push and see how far we can get towards the green curve. So if this is so great, are universities now obsolete? Well, Mark Twain certainly thought so. He said that college is a place where a professor's lecture notes go straight to a student's lecture notes without passing through the brains of either. I beg to differ with Mark Twain, though. I think what he was complaining about is not universities, but rather the lecture-based format that so many universities spend so much time on. So let's go from back even further to Plutarch, who said that the mind is not a vessel that needs filling, but wood that needs igniting. And maybe we should spend less time at universities filling our students' minds with content by lecturing at them, and more time igniting their creativity, their imagination, and their problem-solving skills by actually talking with them. So how do we do that? We do that by doing active learning in the classroom. So there's been many studies, including this one, that show that if you use active learning, interacting with your students in the classroom, performance improves on every single metric, on attendance, on engagement, and on learning as measured by a standardized test. You can see, for example, that the achievement score almost doubles in this particular experiment. So maybe this is how we should spend our time at universities. So to summarize, if we could offer a top-quality education to everyone around the world for free, what would that do? 3 things. First, it would establish education as a fundamental human right, where anyone around the world with the ability and the motivation could get the skills that they need to make a better life for themselves, their families, and their communities. Second, it would enable lifelong learning. It's a shame that for so many people, learning stops when we finish high school or when we finish college. By having this amazing content be available, we would be able to learn something new every time we wanted, whether it's just to expand our minds or to change our lives. And finally, this would enable a wave of innovation, because amazing talent can be found anywhere. Maybe the next Albert Einstein or the next Steve Jobs is living somewhere in a remote village in Africa. And if we could offer that person an education, they would be able to come up with the next big idea and make the world a better place for all of us. Thank you very much.
Taylor, WHFR, Dearborn.
Fall registration for Henry Ford Community College is underway, with a wide variety of programs and degree options to choose from. Let HFCC guide you on your way to higher education. For more information, contact the Office of Registration and Records by calling 313-845-6403 or online at hfcc.edu.
Old and new, hot and cool. It's nothing but the finest blues on Highway 61. I'm Joanne Korchenska. Please join me every Friday from 2 until 6 p.m. for great blues music, only at WHFR.